Thank you. So what I'm going to talk about today is really a automatic and fast failover mechanism for Ethernet software-defined network. So I guess the SDN nowadays is really a buzzword, so I just want to give a really brief introduction to this particular audience. So the idea of SDN is really to decouple control plane from data plane so they can break the existing vertical integration model in the network equipment industry. Like if you look at Cisco, Cisco does chip or firmware system software, and even management software, it does the whole thing. And SDN is trying to break that. And also it enables quicker development and deployment of innovative third-party control protocol. Right? No longer the case that, especially from an academic point of view, if we want to experiment some idea in control protocol, we have to talk to Cisco, Juniper, and so on. But once we have an SDN-like model, then we don't need to do that anymore. Most SDN systems centralize their control plane so they can facilitate the deployment and upgrade of control protocol easily, and also most importantly, you can leverage the global view. The idea of, instead of doing like typical like ISO or OSPF using distributed routing protocol, we want to get a global view and then do a better job of allocating the resources on the network. And the notion of software in a software-defined network really refers to the control protocol, but people also generalize that to application software as well. Now, this is a general model just advocated recently by Open Daylight Initiative for SDN software architecture. Typically, you have a data plane down below. It could be OpenFlow switch, and it could be Ethernet switch, or it could even be software virtual switch. And then there's a controller in the middle. They can control all these switches from a central place. And through some sort of API called Southbound API, in the case of OpenFlow, it's an OpenFlow protocol. And then controller itself exposes a set of API called Northbound API so that the control protocol can actually use a controller Northbound API to develop various kinds of control protocol. But these control protocols are meant to be controlled by somebody else, either by user application directly or by cloud management or orchestration software like OpenStack or vSphere, for example. And that's Northbound API. But our position is SDN is not equivalent to OpenFlow. Right? One could. We ask the question, can we apply SDN to legacy Ethernet switches as well, especially in the cloud data center space? And that's the Peregrine system that I'm going to talk about today. So what's wrong with Ethernet? I mean, there's, you know, you just use Ethernet and then you can do it. Why do you want to move to SDN? The evil of all Ethernet is spanning tree, basically. Because the Ethernet is designed to be plug and play. When you plug something into Ethernet, you will try to automatically incorporate that into that spanning tree. And because the Ethernet header doesn't have a loop count, so doesn't have a hop count, and therefore, in order to prevent loops, it builds a spanning tree on top of whatever physical topology. And because of that spanning tree, not all physical links are used, so there's no load balancing routing, and the failover latency is fairly high. Every time something breaks, you have to reconstruct the spanning tree. And then you cannot really support a large number of endpoints. Like most of the commodity Ethernet switches forwarding table is pretty small, like less than 64K, for example. And it doesn't support VM migration and visibility. Natively, it doesn't support the notion of network virtualization. The idea of if you have a single physical network, on top of that, you can have hundreds of virtual networks running simultaneously. More or less like you have a hypervisor. You can virtualize a physical machine into multiple virtual machines. That notion is not in the original Ethernet design. So Peregrine is designed to be sort of like, imagine we start from the basic thing. I just have a network, a mesh of commodity Ethernet switches. How far can we push this to support the kinds of functionality that we want? And it uses a centralized control plane just like most SDN system, and the data plane is obviously distributed. You just have a bunch of commodity Ethernet switches. So what do? The first step we do is turn off all the Ethernet control protocol. So what are the essence of the Ethernet control protocol? It's basically spanning tree. First you build up a spanning tree, and then how do you build out a forwarding table, source learning? When a particular packet comes through port number 11, into this switch, then you remember that in order to get to the source of this packet from this point on, go through port number 11. That's source learning. And if you don't know what to do, then flood, and then that's another way. Or whenever you want to do some mapping from IP to MAC address, or you want to get IP, you go through ARP and DHCP. All these things have to go. So we turn off all of them on Ethernet switches. Now, Ethernet switches just become nothing but a dumb packet forwarding device with blank forwarding table. That's what we want. That's exactly what we want these Ethernet switches to be. And then from that point on, we can do centralized load balancing. Like we can collect the real-time traffic metrics among all the hosts connected to this network to build the traffic metrics. And then we do load balance. We do some sort of load balancing routing to compute the routes for each pair of hosts, and then populate these computed routes on the forwarding table. And we can also do fast failover, and this is what this talk about. And we can also do low overhead network virtualization, no tunneling and no VLAN, right? So the software architecture is really just reading the yellow parts. Basically, on each of the hosts, we plant a Peregrine agent that does certain things. And then it has two centralized servers. One is called directory server. So think of it as an app server, right? Traditionally, app request, when you want to send out an app request, the app request is a broadcast packet. And whoever listens to it, and then this is my query, then I answer it. So that's the traditional app model. Now we turn around and say that the app query will be answered by a centralized app server, which is the directory server. And then we have another server called ICE. That's the guy that collects the real-time traffic metrics and computes routes and installs these routes on the forwarding table. So you have two central servers and a set of per host agents. So you map all these things into the SDM framework that I just listed. The data plane now consists of Ethernet switches. The southbound API is just SNMP and command line interface. And the controller base does a bunch of basic things, like, you know, you have to worry about what are the set of physical devices on the network, and you keep some bookkeeping for those resources. And then you can do SNMP trap processing. When it come back, you have to figure out deliver to the proper control plane application. And when you want to configure Ethernet switches, this controller will provide some abstract API for control plane application to call to configure various kinds of Ethernet switch. And finally, it provides the traffic load information. And this is useful for load balancing routing. So the controller part is a thin layer that does the basic chores of what's going on in a physical network. The real brain intelligence are sitting on the control plane applications. And the northbound API is a bunch of those things, and then we now have these three applications. So today's talk is mainly about number two, fast failover. So how do we do this fast failover? It basically consists of data plane failover and control plane failover, right? So the data plane failover is whenever you have a link or switch failure, what happens? What do? Control plane failure, what happens if you have these two centralized controller fail? Then what happens? That's control plane failover. So for the data plane failover, basically we do proactive backup route setup. The idea is that for every host pair, we compute the primary route as well as a backup route. And these two routes are pre-computed, and then we pre-install them there already. Now, the first thing that we have to ask ourselves is, how do I choose which one of the routes to use? So for example, we get to a particular host, X. I give this host two MAC addresses, essentially two names. So each name corresponding to, one name corresponds to the primary path, the other name corresponds to the backup path. So if I want to send a packet through the primary path, I use the primary MAC address. If I want to get to that host through the backup path, then I use its backup MAC address. So that's the idea. In the Ethernet, that's the trick that we play. Now, abstractly, we can think of the way we do this thing is that for a set of hosts, for each host X, essentially all the other hosts reach this particular host form a spanning tree. And they don't have to share the same spanning tree. Different hosts can have a different set of spanning tree. Now, for each such host, we are going to build two spanning trees. One is the primary spanning tree, the other is the backup spanning trees. And like I said, that, you know, how to designate which spanning tree to use is through the MAC addresses assigned to the host. Now, these two spanning trees, you know, rooted at the same host, should in some sense disjoint from each other. That's the way to do it, right? So whenever something happens on the primary one, I can switch to the backup immediately. And the reason I can do this is they are somewhat disjoint. Now there are two kinds of disjointness notion. One is disjoint tree, the other is disjoint path. So I'm going to use this example to illustrate that. So on the left, upper left, you see a physical topology of the network. So if you take a disjoint tree, design, and now the host in question is X that we are talking about. So like I say, for each host, we are going to form spanning tree, right? Actually two spanning tree, one is the primary, one is the backup. So if you take the disjoint tree design, that means that X, S1, and Y, ZW, that forms one tree. And the other tree is on the right. So you see that these two trees are disjoint from each other. None of them pass disjoint, right? Except at the endpoints. Now, if you take the disjoint path design, then you don't have to do it. So the granularity of disjointness is on a path level, not on a tree level. So for example, between X and Y, you can take X, S1, Y, and the alternative path or backup path is X, S2, and Y. Right. Now, if when you come to X and Z, you say the primary is X, S2, Z, and the backup is X, S1, Z. So the thing to note here is that if you look at, because it's at the path level, it's easier to manage things. So for example, you can have like X, the primary path of X and Y overlap with the backup path of X and Z. This is allowed in the case of disjoint path design. That's not allowed in the disjoint tree design. In the disjoint tree design, the entire tree have to be, the two trees have to entirely disjoint from each other. So the trade-off between the disjoint tree design and disjoint path design is routing flexibility. If you use disjoint tree design, that means you don't have that much flexibility because the degree of disjointness is stronger. So it makes it more difficult to find plausible routes. But the good thing about disjoint tree design is it's an address resolution map size is smaller, which I'm going to get to just in a minute. Now, the second question is that, okay, so now we have these two trees. So for each host pair, now we have a primary path and backup path we set up, and then we install them on the switches already. Whenever something happens, I need to notify the right parties, and then from this point on, you should get to that guy through his alternative or backup path. And how do we do that? So we need to hack the ARP protocol. That's why we need to centralize this ARP query and response. So like I say, every host is assigned two interfaces and two MAC addresses. And all the ARP query will get intercepted and redirected to this centralized ARP server. Now, in the case of disjoint tree design, it's very simple. Like when you ask a question like, what is the MAC address of IP? And that goes to that particular ARP server, you would answer that. And you need probably like a M entry if the number of hosts in the network is M, right? Now, in the case of disjoint path, you actually have to ask what is the source address that's asking this question, plus what's the destination IP address the question is about. So you actually need to take source MAC plus the IP address that you are asking about into consideration and then answer the question. Now, the answer is like, no, for this particular IP address, it has two MAC addresses. And these two addresses, it has two availability bits to indicate which one are working. So it could be both are working. And that flag says that which one is in action, is active right now. So that's the response of ARP. And this is the generalized ARP response that we create and send to the host. So now the host can decide that, okay, this guy has two way to, I have two way to get to it, but now I want to use the first way. And that's where the flag indicates. So now with all this machinery in place, we can really do the data plane failover. So it consists of the following step. The first step is failure detection. So when some link or switch failure, what happens? We are counting on the existing Ethernet switches can already detect that and then send out SNMP trap, which is generally true, except it's not very fast. Because most of the existing, especially commodity Ethernet switches, doing this failure detection or SNMP trap sending through a polling mode. So it probably polled the interface to query about the health of the interface and so on. And usually they don't set this polling frequency too high, and that would limit the failure detection latency. And a better implementation is interrupt, which is not that common, all right? And the second step is this particular SNMP trap will get to this route server. The route server would actually receive this SNMP trap, and then you try to find out what are the set of hosts or paths that actually go through this particular fail link or fail switch. And then you notify the directory server, the ARP server. And the ARP server will then figure out that based on its address and resolution map, saying that, okay, I need to notify the right guy. The guys, to notify those guys that are affected, saying that from this point on, you should use their corresponding backup routes because the primary route already affected by this particular switch or link failure. And then finally, asynchronously, this route server will remove this all these affected paths and then compute a new path for them and install them. Right. So the critical path is number 1, 2, 3. First, you have to detect the failure. Second, you have to find out who are affected. And third, you have to notify them. Send them from that point on, change names. Use the alternative MAC address to get to the guy that are affected. So So this figure basically illustrates this idea that, so in this particular picture, it's a very simplified picture. We have physical machine 1, PM1, and physical machine 2, PM2. And it has two paths, two disjoint paths, PM1, SW2, SW3, PM2. That's primary. And then PM1, SW1, SW4, PM2. That's backup. All right. So let's imagine that a particular link goes down. It's between PM1 and SW2. It goes down. Then the first thing happen is a link down trap, SNMP trap, will get sent from SW2 to RIS. This is a route server. And route server will figure out which paths actually get affected by this particular failure, and then notify DS. That's step number three. And then DS would actually send a notification to PM1 saying that the path that PM1 uses, the primary path that PM1 uses to reach PM2, now is affected by this failure. So PM1 should use the backup path, which is PM1, SW1, SW4, PM2, to get to PM2. Now the tricky part here is that you notice that for DS to notify PM1, it doesn't go through DS SW2 PM1 directly. It actually knows to route around the failure. So it uses DS SW2 SW4 SW1 PM1 to notify. And this indicates one of the problems that I'm going to talk about. That during failover processing, because the network is already somehow, you know, compromised, and how do I make sure that there's a reliable messaging during the failover process? That turns out to be the most tricky part of the entire business. So the usual way to do this is to do out-of-band control network, right? You have a network that you want to control, and you have a separate network that control it. This really doesn't solve the problem. So for example, in open flow network, they tend to use an open flow network and then a control network which is based on Ethernet. But because Ethernet, if there's something wrong with the control network, then it takes, you know, equally long time to recover. So it doesn't really help, because eventually you still need to solve the problem. When something goes wrong, it's either the data network itself or control network itself. You want the overall failover latency to be reduced. So you cannot rely on the traditional method to do it. So the problem with out-of-band control network is, once again, out-of-band control network itself can fail, right? There's no reason to say that it won't fail. And once it fails, you still need to have fast failover. So the first problem with this reliable messaging during failover is, how do you make sure the SNMP trap reliably get to, from the switch detecting the failure, get to the RIS, the route server? So to do this, we have to configure all the switches in such a way that it will send multiple SNMP traps through disjoint paths to the route server. So that's something that we need to do. And the second thing is that the communication between RIS and DS, right? RIS is the guy that compute who get affected and then forward this information to DS. What if that communication path is broken because of the failure? And then what happens? So we have to do special thing to route around them. Similarly, what if the notation pass from the DS to all the guys that get affected, saying that you guys should change paths? What if that communication is affected by the failure? Again, the DS actually have to understand that whatever path that it's using to notify this guy, if those paths already get compromised, they have to switch them first and then notify, right? So that's the additional thing that we need to do. Now this figure shows that the various case for reliable SNMP trap delivery. So in this case, if the failure happens between two switches, like the case A, the SW1 and SW2, actually two guys will notice that. SW1 and SW2 will notice that. They would both try to forward this information to RIS. So this is like an easier case. Now the more tricky case is case B. The failure actually happens between a switch and the endpoint, a host. In this case, the only one guy that see that, that's SW3. And then SW3 would actually send the SNMP3 through a longer path, SW3, SW1, SW2, and then get to RIS, rather than trying to send it directly, right? Because that might get affected by the failure. And then case three is the failure actually happens between SW2 and RIS itself. So this, in this case, there's no way for SW2 to send. Even SW2 already detect the failure. There's no path for SW2 to get to RIS. So RIS itself needs to be able to detect it, right? So these are the three cases. Now, the next thing I want to talk about briefly is the control plane failover. This is pretty standard HA support for all the, you know, standard server. So for both the route server and directory server, we use a master slave, and all the persistence data keep on some sort of disk partition, and this disk partition are replicated using DRBD. Now, in order to save the login overhead, we choose in-memory log replication rather than on-disk login. And we use pacemaker to do health monitoring and do switchover. Now, at the time of recovery, when something goes down, the slave will come back up and try to recover. So we reconstruct all these critical metadata, either from the log and or from the on-disk data. So this is a pretty standard sort of HA stuff. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about the evaluation. So the test bed that we use are actually sort of tens, there are two racks, so total 88 hosts. And there are eight TOR switches for each of the, there are four TOR switches for each of the racks, so total there are eight TOR switches. And these eight TOR switches are connected to two sort of regional switches, the 48 port, the 10G switch. And the metric that we are measuring is the failover latency. Whenever some link or switch failure, what is the perceived service disruption time from a network connections point of view? And the way to do it is to establish a UDP connection between two hosts. And that path between these two hosts would definitely go through a particular link or switch failure that we want to measure. And then we send a UDP packet every millisecond. And then we measure the number of lost UDP packets during that failover period. And for the breakdown of this failover latency, there are three components. One is the failure detection time, the time when a hardware failure occurs until the SNMP trap actually arrives at the RIS. Right? This is completely done by the switches. We have no control over. And then the damage assessment is the one that once you find a particular link or switch failure, you want to find out which paths get affected. That's damage assessment. And finally, the update is the guide. The DS will notify all the guys that get affected, saying that they should switch to alternative MAC addresses to get to the affected destinations. So the first case is the link failover latency. So this is a pretty busy graph. The most important part is on the right, is the service disruption time. Our original goal is 100 milliseconds. And it turns out that they are still far off from their goal. It's all about, like, there are four cases. Like, if the failure, the link failure occurs between a switch and the host, or between two switches, or between switch and the directory server, or between a switch and IS. These are the four cases. Okay, and then on the right, you see that the latencies, the failover latency is pretty high, not as low as we want. But the best case is between switch and two switch and case. And the reason is because the failure detection is pretty short in that case. Turns out that our 10G regional switch, they have a very good failure detection performance. They use interrupt-driven way to detect failure and can report SNMP trap very quickly. Whereas all the other cases, they use polling. And that's why most of the time of the service disruption time is due to failure detection column, if you look at that. So this is, points to one direction that we need a switch vendor to do. They get their SNMP trap to be done as quickly as possible. They would immediately solve our problem. The other two steps, damage assessment and updates, are completely under our control, and they are pretty small. The only anomaly is a switch-to-switch case. In this case, because there are so many paths that get affected, because the switch-to-switch is between the TOR switch and the regional switch, so a lot of paths actually go through that. And so that's why it takes longer than all the other cases. Now, switch failover latency is also similar, except that on the right column, again, service disruption time is even longer. And the problem is, again, due to failure detection. Like, in this case, how do we determine whether a switch completely failed? We get a bunch of link failures from all the guys, neighboring switches, that notice that how come all the packet going through this failed switch no longer works. So we get a bunch of link failure. And then we pin a couple of times in order to make sure that switch indeed is non-responsive. So that process will take longer. And that's why the failure detection time is longer, and that's why the service disruption time is proportionally longer. And also the update and damage access time tends to be larger, because a switch failure tends to affect a much larger number of paths than a link failure. So we need to figure out which paths get affected and notify them. That time is also increased. But the majority still come from failure detection. And there's really not much we can do here. This is a trade-off between accuracy and responsiveness, right? We don't really want to generate a lot of false positive. Rather, we want to err on the conservative side. Like, we have to be absolutely sure that it fails before we declare that it fails. And that takes time to make that determination. Finally, the failover latency for the server part is also pretty okay. Like on the right hand side, it's like 2 to 3 seconds. And if you look at it, the failure detection time is, again, we have to use a couple of heartbeats and then determine whether it's indeed fails or not. And not only we have to do failure detection, DRBD itself also need to do failure detection to determine who is the master, who is the slave. So that's the DRBD switch time. Our time is just on a state recovery. Once we determine that the master slave, the slave takes over, and you need to reconstruct all the essential critical meta state. That's the amount of time that state recovery column represents. So in conclusion, I just want to impress you guys that the Peregrine is one of the first Ethernet-based SDN system that supports both control plane and data plane failover. It's actually fairly sort of comprehensive. Like, we actually run through various cases in order to make sure. This probably takes like 6 months just to do corner case testing to make sure all these cases actually work. And the basic idea of a data plane failover is actually pretty well known. Like in the internet backbone, people use this idea all the time. The only new thing that we do here is that we do it on the Ethernet networks. And like the idea of using 2 MAC addresses to determine which one to go and to use centralized ARP processing to make sure that the right one is used at the right time. And also the reliable messaging during failover also takes a lot of time to develop. In contrast, the control failover is actually fairly easy. Like, this is sort of like pretty standard HA support for most of the internet servers literature. They are doing almost the same thing. And our next step is really to port Peregrine to OpenFlow switches. Like I said, that the whole point of OpenFlow or SDN is really about dynamic traffic engineering. The idea of being able to use the network resources as efficiently as possible based on the network traffic and then load balance the loads on the links in a way corresponding to the traffic loads. So that's something that Peregrine already have done on Ethernet, and we are trying to see that whether such an abstraction, that the kind of thing that we do for Peregrine can be quickly ported to OpenFlow based on that SDN framework we set up with the proper southbound, northbound API. So all the intelligence could have been reused, that get developed for Peregrine could have been reused for OpenFlow switches as well. All right, thank you.
Hi, thanks for the nice talk.
Yes.
Just a question, do you maybe have a notion of the scalability of a system, particularly for the discovery service and also the ARP, central ARP server, which has to process a request?
We think the ARP can probably handle up to like 2,000 hosts without any problem, based on the kind of ARP frequency. And probably we have ARP cache, but mm-hmm. set it to 1 minute expiration time, that kind of thing. We probably can handle 2,000 hosts without any problems.
And do you think it would make maybe sense to have 2 ARP servers?
Yes, so eventually probably we'll do clustering, like if you want to scale it up like that. So even in the SDN community, they are talking about controller cluster already.
Okay,
yes.
Cool. Thank you. Mm.
I also have a question. So do you consider the correlated failures backup path selection?
Right now we only deal with one failure. That's right. We don't deal with like more than one failure at this point. So yes, it's possible that in the future we can enhance it to deal with more sophisticated failure scenario like what you're saying.
Okay.